the European Central Bank promises to swoop in to the rescue.
And in this country, companies don't seem to be investing in the future. Hello, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith in New York.
I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update for July 26th. It is a Thursday. We'll talk about a lot of things on the show today, including, you know, in this election season, you hear a lot from Republicans about taxes and growth. And you can trace the roots of that back to an economist named Arthur Laffer, considered the father of supply side economics. So we talked to him today for Marketplace, and we will have that perhaps controversial for some folks conversation coming up a little later.
And speaking of election issues, oil prices are always a big one. And did you know, Jeff, that there are 7 gallons of oil in a standard car tire?
No. Who would know that? Very few people.
I know that. But only after doing some research, because we have a piece coming up on soybean tires. That is coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
So when Stacey and I first sat down in our jobs this morning, stocks in Europe were heading for another kind of lousy day. But then, midway through the morning, a bolt out of the blue, the head of the European Central Bank said the ECB will do, quote, whatever it takes to preserve the euro. Mario Draghi's comments were like a cortisone shot of confidence for investors, apparently. But for more on what muscle the ECB can really bring to bear here, Marketplace's London Bureau Chief Stephen Beard is with us. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Jeff.
What specifically did Draghi say that markets are so excited about?
Well, not a lot, really. I mean, he hinted at a new, more activist role for the European Central Bank in combating the crisis. The markets got excited because investors now believe the only institution that can really stop this crisis in its tracks is the European Central Bank. It's the only body with the firepower to stop the speculation against Italian and Spanish government bonds and against the euro itself.
So this is not a sure thing, but if the ECB stepped in, what precisely could it actually do?
Well, it could behave more like the Fed and print money, pump a lot more cash into these government bond markets. That would certainly bring down borrowing costs in Spain and Italy. The ECB could give the bailout fund a banking license so that the fund could borrow really huge sums of money to do the same thing, to buy directly large quantities of Spanish and Italian government bonds. The ECB could, in theory, do these things, but it won't be easy.
Right. What obstacles might be in the way?
Well, Germany, in a word. I mean, the Germans really don't like this. They fear that this would let the southern Europeans off the hook. It would relax the pressure on the Italians and the Spanish and the Greeks to reform their economies and get their public finances into shape. The Germans say without radical, even painful reform in these countries, the problem will reemerge and the crisis will resume at a later date.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard, thank you very much.
Okay, Jeff.
Stock markets in Asia closed before the European Central Bank news, but they had a decent day. The Asian Dow Index was up 1%. In Europe, though, they got the full brunt of it and celebrated quite a bit. France's CAC 40 led the way. It was up about 4%. Overall in Europe, the Stock 600 Index up a little over 2%. In U.S. markets as well, as I'm speaking at this moment, the Dow, NASDAQ, and S&P all up just a little over 1%.
Well, it's not all roses, Jeff.
What?
We got durable goods orders out this morning. Those are sales of big ticket items, things like computers and equipment. And it's seen as a way to measure how much companies are investing in future growth. And in a word, they're not. Durable goods orders were down more than 1% in June. That's the most in 5 months.
Well, I will see your durable goods news and counter with some unemployment statistics. The Labor Department just reported 353,000 people applied for unemployment benefits last week. And that is down from the week before. It's, in fact, the biggest drop since February of 2011.
That is good news. And we got a lot of good earnings news out, too. I don't mean to sound all doom and gloom. Hershey's, in fact, reported some sweet quarterly profits. That's partly thanks to price increases. And my personal theory that during a bad economy, chocolate sales go up.
Ah, well, not
it's
such
not
good...
official. It's my personal theory.
Good enough for us. Not such good news, though, for Sprint Nextel today. The telecom giant lost more than $1 billion in the last few months as nearly 250,000 customers dropped their Sprint service. And ExxonMobil announced quarterly profits that rose 49%. Shell, on the other hand, saw profits fall 13% from the same quarter last year.
And after the markets close today, we'll get earnings from a few companies, Starbucks, Amazon.com, and Facebook. It's the social network's first earnings report, that since it started selling stock in May. Victor Anthony joins us now from Topeka Capital Markets. Good morning, Victor.
Good morning.
Now, Victor, this is the first earnings report since Facebook went public. What are you going to be looking for?
Well, the first thing I'm going to be looking for is the revenues. I think that's top of mind for most investors. Typically, when a company comes out for the first time after they've IPO'd, it's difficult to project the expenses that they'll incur within that quarter. And so being somewhat more conservative than the street is on the earnings.
What about some of the new potential sources of revenue, things like the storefronts and people voting through Facebook? I mean, are we seeing Facebook expanding in ways that will be profitable, or is it just going to gain momentum through channels it's already got, namely selling ads about using our profile information?
Yeah, so my long-term thesis on Facebook is why I'm bullish on the company, irrespective of whatever numbers they report tonight. So I see them adding an e-commerce business. I see them adding a social search business. You know, there have also been talks about Facebook expanding into online job postings. So I see a lot of these additional monetization opportunities for the platform.
You know, one of the reasons that Facebook has been under so much scrutiny is that it valued itself so much higher than its current earnings. I mean, can it really make all of this money that it's claimed that it can make?
Yeah, that's a good question. And relatively new media companies like Facebook, they tend to be valued at high multiples as long as they deliver on the growth expectations. I see them expanding, as I stated, into e-commerce and all these additional vertical platforms that's likely to add to the growth trajectory of the business. So, you know, I'm confident that they're able to deliver on their growth expectations to justify that multiple that they're currently trading at.
Victor Anthony is an analyst with Topeka Capital Markets. Victor, thank you.
Thank you very much.
So, Stacey, for those folks who've been burned by the Facebook IPO or who maybe put their retirement into Zynga stock.
A bad day for Zynga.
Then why not get out of stocks? Here's another investment idea that's sure to pan out. Please note the sarcasm in my voice. Balloon Boy. You remember Balloon Boy?
That does not sound like a good investment. I don't know what it is.
Oh, yeah. Well,
it
Balloon
does not
Boy.
Sound
okay.
like a good investment.
Let's recap. Balloon Boy was this hoax. It was a flying saucer at first, and then it turned out the story was it was a Mylar balloon with a little boy in it that was floating across Colorado, and he was stranded in the balloon. You missed the Balloon Boy phenomenon, huh? Well, I'm glad I can fill you in. Anyway, it was huge for a day until the thing crash-landed, and everybody freaked out because there was a small child inside. Until there was not a small child inside. It was a hoax by a family that was hoping to get their own reality show. So that's Balloon Boy in a nutshell, as best I can recall it.
Oh, the father.
Yes.
There was, right, the father potentially put him in there. Right, right. I do remember that.
Welcome aboard the big balloon, Stacey.
So
you
well,
can own a piece of Balloon Boy history, specifically a piece of the Balloon Boy balloon. The guy who owns it, he bought it on eBay apparently, is carving it up and embedding it in trading cards, which you can purchase on eBay and in other places. And there's just no telling how this little piece of history could appreciate in value.
Well, speaking of making important eBay investments, Jeff, eBay is working on a special auction site for kids.
Wow.
The Wall Street Journal reports, and I know you have a child who could get them started early.
4 years old.
Yes,
yep,
very early. The Wall Street Journal reports that the under 18 set would have to get parental consent, and the child would have to have access to a PayPal account. And then they could bid and buy just like the grown-ups.
Yeah, that's scary. But of course, it would be just like a chip off the old block, unfortunately, in my case.
Really? What was your latest eBay purchase?
Oh, my goodness. Let me think for a moment.
My dad bought a coyote pelt.
Nice.
Yeah.
I was shopping just yesterday for this is so techie and weird, SATA hard drive to USB converter. That we needn't explain what that is. But
that I'm really impressed, actually.
You put me on the spot.
I'm sorry. I'm really impressed.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
We think of cars as using a lot of oil in the gas tank, of course. But what about the tires? Turns out, Stacy tells me, one standard car tire contains roughly 7 gallons of oil. What's up with that?
Well, I know. Now Goodyear Tire and Rubber is working on an alternative. It's a tire made with soybean oil. Michael Kearns manages the Global Materials Science Group at Goodyear. He's helping to develop the soybean tire. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
So why soybean oil?
Well, we took a look at our possibilities, and Goodyear uses petroleum-based oils typically to aid in the processing of our rubber compounds. And we're always looking to give the company options as a means to free ourselves from, you know, dependence on any one raw material, especially petroleum. Soybean oil is actually readily available in the U.S. If you look at bio-based oils, it's one of the most abundant and cost-effective alternatives that we could find.
From what I understand, this could actually reduce Goodyear's oil use by quite a bit.
Yeah, right now we're looking at exactly how much that would be. And, of course, it depends on the market penetration. But estimates range to as high as over 7 million gallons of oil annually.
So what about the consumer buying these tires? What differences will they see between buying and using a regular tire and buying and using a soybean oil-based tire?
Well, right now we're looking at some of those factors. Currently, we see this as being cost neutral. That's one of the things that we find to be most attractive about soybean oil as an alternative. It seems to be fairly cost effective. But from the consumer's perspective, the tire will look the same. Our initial indications are that they may actually experience an improvement in their tread life. We're currently looking at only treads. So the sidewall of the tire, the inner liner of the tire are not being considered right now. And really, how far this penetrates into our product line and into the actual construction of the tire really depends on how successful we are going forward and, you know, how cost effective this remains to be versus petroleum.
Michael Kearns is the manager of Global Materials Science Group at Goodyear. Michael, thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Soybean tires, eh, Stacy? maybe good in a pinch for a roadside snack, I guess, if you happen to break down. Now on to a much more tasty topic, though. Your family might still be enjoying a summer diet of backyard barbecues and trips to Dairy Queen, but pretty soon kids will be back in school, and they could be facing a much different school lunch than they're used to.
Here to talk with us in today's Midday Extra about the latest changes to school lunches is Sandra Ford, president of the School Nutrition Association. Hi, Sandra.
Hi.
So what are some of the changes in the works when it comes to school lunches?
Two big ones. The first is the incorporation of whole grains into the school lunch menu. And the second really big one is the addition of fruits and vegetables. Students are going to have to choose a fruit or vegetable when they come through the line. So.
or what?
No choice.
Or what?
Or they'll have to pay more for their lunch.
Ah.
What kind of costs are involved, Sandra, in making changes to the school menu?
There is cost associated with it. The fruit and vegetable is going to increase the cost of us providing the meal. The addition of whole grains, right now, the cost is a little bit higher. I think once it becomes normal for the marketplace, the cost may come down a little bit. But we're seeing some increased costs in our bread items, and we're definitely anticipating increased costs just from providing the additional fruits and vegetables, including fresh.
Will kids pay more?
No, kids will not pay more. A lot of districts have raised lunch prices a nickel. But, you know, a nickel isn't a lot more when you're providing maybe 20 cents more worth of food. The students won't pay more. We are going to get an additional 6 cents reimbursement from the federal government for implementing the new guidelines.
You want to make these changes for the sake of the kids' health. Are there interests out there that are opposing you, though?
You know, I think everybody knows that these new nutrition standards, which are based on the new dietary guidelines, are the right thing to do for kids. Change is always difficult for us at any point in time. So I really do believe people's heart knows that it's the right thing. I think it's just the whole process of changing how we do business. You know, the new dietary guidelines really stress the increasing fruits and vegetables in all of our diets, not just kids. So it's the right thing to do for kids. And companies and businesses across the country have really stepped back and reinvented and reformulated their products to meet these new standards.
And what, if any, are some of the economic benefits of having school lunch? You mentioned that there is a cost, that you're eating some of the cost. Are there some economic benefits to school lunch?
I think the benefits of school lunch are more focused on the student. It is definitely important for the student to have meals at school to be ready to learn. And I think the connection between nutrition and student learning is a critical element. So I see more the benefit to the student than the benefit to me as a district director running a program.
And I certainly understand you wouldn't want to antagonize your possible enemies through our podcast. How likely that is, I don't know. But I'm thinking back to a recent example. Wasn't it with potatoes, right? Whether potatoes were a vegetable, wasn't that highly controversial? And didn't they wind up remaining classified as a vegetable at the end of all that?
Actually, there was two things. There was the potatoes as a vegetable, as a starchy vegetable,
Okay. And
limiting starchy vegetables in the new meal pattern, which starchy vegetables are still limited, but not at the level that was originally proposed. The thing I think you're talking about is the tomatoes,
Okay. And
the tomato paste in pizza.
Yes,
there was a lot of controversy centered around whether or not we could continue to count the tomato paste in pizza as meeting the vegetable requirement for the school lunch program.
Uh-huh.
Quite honestly, I never counted it in the first place, and a lot of my colleagues didn't count it. But it has been allowed to remain as counting as part of the vegetable component in the school lunch program.
You can't get away from politics entirely.
No.
Yeah.
No. We're a very politically charged program.
Sandra Ford is president of the School Nutrition Association. Sandra, thanks for speaking with us.
No problem.
From school lunches to the farmers who grow a lot of the school lunches, thousands of farmers from across the country will gather in a small town in Tennessee today to learn about farming without a plow. If you hadn't heard yet, Stacy, or you haven't gotten a celebratory greeting card, it is No-Till Field Day.
I didn't know
here
that.
Here in the U.S.,
no.
Apparently, or maybe internationally. I don't know. It's not a terribly popular holiday, but this year's drought could change that. From WPLN in Nashville, here's Blake Farmer.
It's an event billed as the largest gathering devoted to no-till farming in the country. And organizer Blake Brown says it began 30 years ago, not in response to drought like the one going on now. At the time, West Tennessee had one of the worst erosion problems in the country. Topsoil was washing away by the truckload.
Back at that time, we were losing 30 to 40 tons per acre per year just from soil erosion.
Brown says researchers began looking for a better way to farm. This is the old way. An antique tiller rips through the dirt, turning under last year's crop to make way for the next. Ag experts discovered if you could find a way around plowing, it did wonders for making the soil stay put. It's also been found to help crops weather dry spells. Planting crops amidst the previous year's foliage may not be pretty. It's been called farming ugly. But early adopter Dickie Brewer says in a video for the University of Tennessee Institute for Agriculture, no-till works in hot and dry years like this one.
If you keep that cover on it, it traps that and holds the soil and also helps hold the moisture where it can soak in the ground and keep the soil actually cooler in the summertime.
There is a drawback, I'm told. No-till ends up requiring more weed-killing chemicals, which has become a problem with the rise of Roundup-resistant weeds. But many farmers now swear by the method, especially in Tennessee. A record 74% of the acreage growing major crops this year is no-till. UT Extension agent Justin Reinhart says it's become the industry standard.
It's really best management practices that we would consult with these guys to use anyway, but they become more important when production is limited by drought or any other severe weather.
Nationwide, untilled acreage has grown to roughly 35% and inches up each year. The USDA is encouraging farmers to ditch the plow. Mother Nature may push more farmers to go ahead and pull the trigger. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
The Olympics get underway officially tomorrow, and I guess you could call it Olympics 2.0. There's been a big technology and social media push this year. Rory Kethlin-Jones joins me now. He's the BBC's technology correspondent. Good morning, Rory.
Good morning.
So tell me about the latest in Olympic technology. What are some of the hot items being tested at this year's Games?
Well, this is probably the first social media Olympics. It's also the first app Olympics. Lots of applications being used by both spectators and the athletes themselves to try to get an edge on their rivals. I've heard of the British boxing team, for instance, using a clever app which has analysed all of their rivals' potential moves so that they can know what to expect, where the next punch is coming from. And also lots of applications out there for spectators to use to really get a grip on what's happening in the games.
And from what I understand, too, a lot of the athletes are gaining a bigger audience and fans by tweeting and making friends on Facebook and things like that.
That's absolutely right. In fact, the International Olympic Association has set up a social media hub. It's encouraging people to use Facebook and Twitter to communicate with their fans. Although, of course, there are dangers in that. And they're also being warned about the pitfalls of saying inappropriate things on those networks and getting into trouble.
Visa is a longtime Olympic sponsor, and from what I understand, they have plans for a cashless Olympics. Is that right?
Yes, they've issued a number of smartphones with payments technology inside them, where you'll be able to pay at the Olympic venues for goods and services. Now, this is a bit of an experiment. It has to be said, we've been expecting mobile money to come along and be a real force in the world for some time. It's been very slow to arrive, and I think Visa is hoping that the Olympics will give this a bit of a push. It must be said, I think they wanted it to be a cashless Olympics, but of course that's not going to happen because most people just don't have the technology to make that work.
Do you have to buy a special phone, or is it an app you can download on your mobile phone?
At the moment, you have to have a special phone with this program installed, but this should become more widely available. And as I say, they're hoping that the Olympics will showcase this and convince people, skeptical consumers, frankly, that there is a worth to this.
Rory Kethlen-Jones is the BBC's technology correspondent. Rory, thank you.
Thank you.
If you want to find the roots of today's Republican economic message, you can look to a small dinner in 1974. Dick Cheney was there, Donald Rumsfeld, and an economist named Arthur Laffer. As the story goes, Laffer sketched a curve, later called the Laffer Curve, showing how lower tax rates might actually increase government revenue. And the rest is history. The taste for so-called supply-side economics has waxed and waned over the years, but it is now very much back in vogue. Arthur Laffer was one of Ronald Reagan's top economic advisors. He did a stint in academia, and he now runs a research firm he founded. And this morning, he is on Marketplace. Good to talk with you.
It's good to talk with you, Jeff.
I think it's fair to say, correct me if I'm wrong, that the one main thing you would like to see above all else is lower taxes.
Well, what I'd love to see is a lower tax rates and a broader tax base. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be a revenue enhancer or a revenue loser. But, you know, any major improvement would help the country enormously. We've got to get the job machine running again and get things really going.
What's so wrong about raising taxes on this small segment of wealthy Americans and lowering them or keeping them the same for other folks?
Yeah, well, the problem with raising taxes on rich people, what they call rich people, is rich people have many options open to them that other people don't have, and you won't get the money. You know, if you could get the money from them without costs, I'd love it, but you can't.
Many economists will say the data is extremely inconclusive in practice as to how marginal tax changes actually affect personal and business activity. What makes you so sure?
Well, because these economists you talk about never worked in the real world. They're just looking at the econometrics and the data there. If you ever go and look at what's being recommended today from CPA firms, from financial planners, if you actually look at how they go through, do their tax returns, believe me, they are more focused on their taxes than you and I are on their taxes.
But am I right that I just heard you criticize economists for actually looking at the data and making their
decisions
based on
that? No, not looking at
the
data. I think it's wonderful to look at the data, but I think it's really silly to look at these aggregate data and not make any judgments beyond those aggregate data.
But you're also arguing for a bit of common sense.
Yeah, a lot of common sense. Even if you did get more money from the top 1%, it would be more than offset by the losses other people would not pay in taxes because these people aren't employing as many people, aren't investing as much, aren't buying as much. I mean, it's much more than just one little group.
Many other economists, left, right, and center, will point to various kinds of data that show income and wealth inequality in the U.S. are increasing, maybe the worst in many, many years. And yet, your center just put out a report claiming to debunk this narrative on income inequality. Are you saying that's not true?
I don't mind inequality if people are rising in incomes in all groups. I do mind equality when everyone's brought down to the lowest common denominator. You don't want to make the rich poor. You want to make the poor richer. These inequality specialists all around the place aren't proposing that. In all the quest to achieve less inequality, they are creating equality by lowering everyone. And that's silly.
Economist Arthur Laffer, father of supply-side economics, with Laffer Associates, Laffer Investments, and the Laffer Center. Good to talk with you. Thanks.
Very nice talking with you, Jeff.
So, Stacey, I have been watching already some of the angry comments roll in on the Arthur Laffer interview online. And
it's politics.
Yeah, it is politics. It is touchy stuff, no doubt about it. And if, like many people, these tax debates make you out there want to curse a blue streak, you might avail yourselves of Schimpflos. It is the German swearing hotline, and it recently opened. That translates to swear away. Two entrepreneurs set this thing up so anybody can call in and blow off steam at a stranger for about $2 a minute. I don't know. Do you think they have to swear in German in order to take part?
No. I bet you could swear in any language.
They'll take your money.
They'll take your money. Exactly. And one more item from our bizarre entrepreneurship desk, Jeff. So the maker of Bratz dolls is suing Lady Gaga for $10 million.
What? Bratz doll? That's what I shopped for last on eBay. It had escaped my mind. Yes, Bratz.
Well, MGA Entertainment, which signed a deal with Lady Gaga to produce a Lady Gaga doll, the doll would sing and wear some of Lady Gaga's crazy outfits.
Cool.
But it's been delayed. Apparently, there's a hang-up because Lady Gaga wants to hold the doll until her new album is released next year. And she wants to make some changes to the doll, including having the doll's face redone to look more like a, quote, supermodel.
Which is to say, if you're Lady Gaga, not like me? That's a little weird. Does it look not enough like her, or does it look like her and she knows it and she wants it to look more like a supermodel?
Like a supermodel? Well, if you're going to have a doll, you know, you might as well go crazy, right? Good hair and everything.
Makes me want to head to eBay right now. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Horwich. I'm headed for eBay.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update. From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.